Actually, I was working very hard today. In fact, that right there is a celebratory beer.
Is that right?
Yeah. I dropped the block in the Firebird today, finished her up. You want to see it?
I have no idea what you just said.
Okay, well.
Hello and welcome. Welcome and hello. This is Wait, You Haven't Seen. It's a show where we talk about movies and specifically talk about a movie at least one of us has never seen before. I'm your host, Travis, aka TV's Travis. This is episode number 261. And our movie this week is 2018's Upgrade. And here to talk with me about it, he had seen it and I had not, from the Esoterica Cinema Podcast. It's Jason. Jason, how are you, man?
I am doing well, Travis. It's good to see you, man. It's been a little minute.
It has been. Okay, give me your background, your history with Upgrade, because you brought this one to me. I mentioned it to you, but you latched on immediately. So what's your background with this movie?
Yeah, it was funny. So this is one of those movies that totally just was like not on my radar at all. And, you know, Lee Winnell had like just come out. I think I saw it like right after he came out with Invisible Man, actually. Invisible Man had gotten like a ton of press. And so I was like, and then I didn't really know too much about him. And then I found out that he was like James Wan's boy, who had written like all of his screenplays for like Sinister, Insidious, all this stuff. So I was like, let me go back and check this out. I'm actually a huge sci-fi fan. I'm a huge cyberpunk fan. Anything having to do with like, you know, futuristic technologies, murderous AI, like just I eat that stuff up with a spoon. So I found out that this dude made a movie that was sort of like within that subject matter. And so I watched it and like went in completely blind, didn't even watch a trailer, and was just totally blown away by just the overall vibe. A lot of the development, you know, I feel like this was probably one of those movies where the marketing campaign might have given away some of those secrets that like coming to it late, I didn't know about. Sure. So they were genuinely surprising to me. We'll talk about those over the course of the episode. It really worked. It was tight. It was effective. And a lot of the stuff like that shouldn't have worked, specifically the camera work and the fight scenes, right? Really pretty clever the way that was done. Could have gone completely awry, right? Had they put that in someone else's hands, I don't know that it would have worked. But in the context of this film, really cool action scenes. Loved the sci-fi vibe. Loved the cinematography. Loved the world. So yeah, I am just like all about this movie. I tell everybody I can who hasn't seen it to check it out.
That's awesome. So I do remember some of the marketing for this because my at the time girlfriend saw the trailer for it. She's like, you got to check this trailer out. This looks dope. So we watched the trailer and I was like, that looks really cool. And it was right around the same time that Venom was coming out as a movie. The 2018 Venom with Tom Hardy was around the same time as this, pretty close. And I definitely remember seeing this trailer thinking, boy, that's given me some vibes of like Venom-ish stuff going on. But at the same time, I was like, but it doesn't look exactly the same. It is funny to me that it stars Logan Marshall Green, who... I always call the not Tom Hardy because
exactly. I literally have in my notes his discount Tom Hardy, or as we like to say, Kirkland brand Tom Hardy on our show.
Yep. There you go. I love that. But I remember seeing the trailer and then for whatever reason, I think 2018 was in a period where I wasn't going to the theater nearly as much. And so I just sort of didn't see it. And then it kind of went out of mind and I didn't think about it again for a while. And every once in a while I'd think, man, Upgrade. Oh, I remember seeing the trailers for that. That looked cool. And then forget about it. So when I started doing this show, I keep a list for myself of like my wish list movies that, that I want to be able to watch with people at some point. And this one, I put on there early on. I'm like, I got to find somebody who either hasn't seen it either or loves it and I can do this. And it hadn't worked out so far. But once I mentioned it to you and you're like, yes, let's do that. Cause you got real excited about it. And that was cool to me. So this was fun to finally sit down and watch. And outside of that trailer, I went into it blind as well. I didn't research anything. I knew Logan Marshall Green was in it. I think I read somewhere at some point, Lee Wanell had written and directed this, but like watching it for this, I didn't even think about that going into it. I just was like, all right, movie, show me what you got. And damn, this was like right up my alley. Cause I'm like you, cyberpunk yeah. stuff. Love it. Love. Yeah. Just give me all the, put it right in my veins, man. Zane cyberpunk. And that
did you
like,
play the game at all?
Yeah, I did a little bit.
Yeah. Fine. We got around to that one. That was a good one.
What I love about it is it's that like, this is that type of cyberpunk stuff that is that like 15 minutes into the future, right?
Yeah.
It's future, exactly. But it's not so far that it's a completely different world.
Sure.
But it's also not current. It's not our present day at all.
Yeah.
And I absolutely love that kind of stuff.
Yeah. You're talking about like a guy like biomechanicals and stuff like that, you know? Mm-hmm. But to your point, and I think that's probably one of those decisions you have to make when you're, you know, writing and creating and ideating the film, which is like, I know that I'm not a name. I don't have a big name actor. I'm not going to get a ton of money to make this movie. So I can't go like full, you know, Blade Runner with it, right? And do this hugely imaginative world. But instead, what it does is very, in a much similar way to Ex Machina, I thought, you know, mm-hmm. took advantage of just a couple really strong locations. And it's funny because to your point, you actually see that this is, you know, right when the start of all this stuff is coming around. So, you know, you've got the sort of like cyber truck that, you know, the wife has and that a couple other very wealthy people have. But like most of the cars on the road are just traditional sedans, trucks, et cetera, look like all the cars that we see today. So by putting it in that sort of transitory period where it's like early stage, you know, it allows them to manage the production budget while still introducing a lot of these more imaginative and futuristic devices within the context of the movie.
Yeah, which was great because I love that, like, you know, here's Gray is sort of, he's just an old school work with his hands, you know, yeah. turning a wrench guy. Okay, so Lee Whannell wrote this, and what I will, if I nitpick it at all, it's very tropey. But I sure. don't mind that. Like yeah. tropes, my view on that is tropes exist for a reason.
Sure.
And they're not, I don't think of a trope as a bad word. Mm-hmm. When they're done poorly or they're done lazily, yeah, it can take you out of something. But to have tropes in your movie, not a bad thing at all. And then when you can execute them well, which this yeah. one does. But yeah, I love the mixture of, and it's a dirty world. It's grimy. It's dark. You know, he goes to a house and it's a trailer. That first house he goes to, it's got the cheap wood paneling on the walls. Not everything is clean and like antiseptic. So it just feels like a lived in world. What was cool about this for me was it's very much a self-contained story, and it felt like felt to me like something you would find in an old pulp.
Yep. 100%. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Which
Philip K. Dick vibes for sure. You know, even down yeah. to just that, you know, sort of old school blue collar protagonist that's sort of yep. like, you know, a little bit of like an older guy in this new world, you know, like we see that a lot, whether it's a detective character, mechanic character, soldier character, but usually Dick's protagonists usually have that like old school gruff kind of, you know, just blue collar worker guy protagonist. And so this film definitely carries that tradition over.
Yeah. And I love that he works on cars and he's, you know, he's got all his stuff there. But what I liked too about it was like that made him attractive to STEM, and made, because STEM finds out about him through working on the car for the character of Aaron. And because he's basically, for lack of a better term, kind of unsullied by technology, STEM is like, this is the perfect vehicle for me to do my upgrade. And I did read that the original working title for this was STEM, and okay. they changed it to Upgrade. And I think Upgrade works better as a title.
Yeah, I agree.
Because it also fits in thematically. I think STEM would have confused people more than anything else. But to name the chip STEM, I thought was a cool way to do that.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. And especially once you factor in like the very ending, which, you know, I won't give away until we get there, but,
yeah, again, we're going to get there though. Just so everyone knows.
Right.
Yeah. Just so everyone knows, we're going to be spoiling this movie. So if you really worry about that, you can pause this, go watch the movie. It's streaming on Max right now. And then come back because there's no way to talk about this without it.
Yeah.
So Logan Marshall Green, we've kind of talked about, you know, jokingly calling him the Kirkland brand, Tom Hardy. He's really good. Yeah. I've only seen him in a few things, but him in this, I liked him in Prometheus, for the role that he had in that. I think he is very good. Here, he gets to be a few different facets. And what is really cool to me is, like, he starts off, he's definitely the loving husband. Like, they have a very good relationship, and we establish that right away. Mm-hmm. And so because they take the time to establish that, when his wife is killed and he's paralyzed, you care. Yeah. And which is great, in terms of, like, as an audience, you care about what happened to him. And then he spends the rest of the movie very just, like, deflated. And even when things are going well for him, in the context of the movie, like, he's still not 100% on board with this, the methods that things are going on with, which, yeah, I kind of liked. And I think that his portrayal of it really, really worked for me. I thought Logan Marshall Green was great in this as Gray.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can tell that all the time, you know, even when STEM is, you know, has taken over and is giving him a quote unquote, like, well, not normal lifestyle, but at least allows him to walk around and have all of the normal functions he did when he was healthy. You know, he still kind of always knows in the back of his head that, like, it's not really him pulling the trigger, right? And making all of these things happen. And even when he starts to get a little cocky and forgets that, STEM's like, hey, I can turn off and you'll be completely paralyzed again. Like, don't forget who's in charge here, buddy, you know? And so because of that, it gets into this thing where this man who, having agency above all else, was the most important thing in the world to him, kind of comes to understand that, like, he's never going to have that again, ever. And even when he is sort of, you know, believes that he has agency, it's almost like he's being tricked into it. And, you know, in a moment's notice, again, STEM can remind him that, you know, it's not him. So he carries that, you know, again, it's like, I feel, you know, as a very proud person myself, right, who just probably is way too hyper independent and, like, you know, doesn't like help for anything. You know, I believe I could very much appreciate that and sort of, you know, relate to that, of just that whole feeling of how resentful someone could become as a result of just not having that agency, you know?
Yeah. Well, and for him to be somebody who works with his hands, who does everything physically, and then not only is that taken away from him, he has to rely on technology, which he railed against before, doesn't have a choice now. And then, and that's before STEM comes along.
Like, yeah.
You know, he's stuck in that chair and all this, and then STEM comes along. And it's funny because he has those moments of, like, oh, this maybe isn't so bad, followed by, you know, something horrible will happen. And, like, he's trying to process it. And so he goes, like, you could read it wrong and it could feel like he's going through things a little too quickly, but really it's just, he's being bombarded by so much at any one point that it's hard to keep up with, I would think.
Yeah. Well, and it also has to be like that, you know, STEM has to be that powerful for, or, you know, that complex, that everything that goes along with it, you know, otherwise it's not worth, you know, going to the ends of the earth for the creator to try to get it back and all of that, you know? So,
right.
You know, both sides have to be motivated, both the protagonist and the antagonist. And I think by having this be literally, you know, a technology that is going to change the world overnight when it comes out. Yeah. And if anything, you know, to your point, it does have a really exceptional pace. But I think it does kind of come at the expense of a little bit of world building. Like, it would have been nice to, you know, I sort of like seeing the, you know, real world, you know, we don't need to spend a ton of time, but, like, the politics, for example, of seeing the antagonist trying to get this technology that we as the audience know can, you know, change the world overnight, but being held up by the bureaucracy, right? And testing. Because there's, like, a throwaway line about how he doesn't want to wait, you know, the 2 years or 3 years or whatever and go through all of that. But again, it's like, I think that when you give the antagonist time to go into their motivations, it makes for a more interesting and complex antagonist, right? That's always like in the Marvel problem, right? Is like, they don't have interesting villains because they never really have motivations. Then all of a sudden you get like a Thanos, you know, and it's like, oh, okay, well, now this just made this so much more rich, you know, because that's it's someone that I can actually understand where they're coming from, even if I disagree with the methods employed to get there. Right. So
yeah,
it could have been a little bit more dynamic between some of the different characters, because most of the characters are admittedly a bit throwaway. Like, they're a little bit plot devices more so than like fully fleshed out characters.
Sure.
It probably could have stood to use a little bit more of that. But also, it doesn't, you know, the movie at that point, it does slow the film down, which, you know, that's part of the fun, is this film just moves. It's immediate. You know, it's not one of these like, you know, okay, you know, this happens and like, let's flash forward 3 years later and this and that. It's like, you know, the entire thing is just one after the other. You know, yeah. You start the journey, and much like a very traditional noir film, it's just, you know, we follow the protagonist through on this very sort of short little mini, you know, 2 or 3 day adventure or whatever it turns out to be, right?
Yeah. And I think that lends to kind of where it felt like a pulp story to me.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a short story. You've got your fleshed out protagonist, and everyone else is just sort of there to service that character, as mm-hmm. opposed to something that came from, and I know this was a Lee Wan L, like, he didn't adapt anything.
Yeah.
Obviously he's pulling from pulp novels and detective stories and whatnot. He did claim that he had no idea about Venom prior to writing this. I don't know if he had no idea, but maybe he knew there was a comic character called that and didn't know much about it.
Yeah.
But I will say, like, if this was something adapted from, say, a novel, you'd have more fleshed out characters. Because you're right. That is, if I had a detraction, it would be, it's a little light on the extra characters, but it's also sort of a whodunit.
Yeah.
And so once you start going there, it's a little tougher to really flesh them out. But it is a detriment. It's funny, because this movie does both a lot of world building and not enough world building at the same time.
Sure, yeah.
Because we just get, like,
I mean, it's hard when you're dealing with one of these futuristic societies, and it's like, mm-hmm. you know, you have to establish so many rules. And again, you know, he's like, I think it's very clear that he wanted to tell, you know, an action oriented film, and mm-hmm. you can tell that he made a decision not to do a lot of that world building. Like, we know that he's a talented guy. We've seen that time and time again. But also, oh, sure. we know that, like, you know, if you watch a Denis Villeneuve sci-fi film, like, yeah, they're fantastic, but it's dense. It's a completely different experience, you know. Mm-hmm. There's a yeah. lot of meat on that bone. It tends to be slow. There's a lot to absorb. So it's probably the better and certainly, like, the more esteemed film. But, you know, if everything was a prestige film, then, you know, we wouldn't be able to appreciate them. You need all sorts of films. And so this is more of just, like, the... You know, it feels like almost like the 90s crime thriller version of a cyberpunk story. You know, it's quick, it's yeah. immediate. You know, you're in the shoes of the protagonist. We don't have this sort of bird's eye view of this larger world. It's very much, you know, we're confined to the eyes of our main character.
Yeah.
You know, which kind of usually a larger film would have to have a little bit more of a detached role to just absorb everything that's going on, you know?
Yeah, I do like that. You know, we never know anything more than Gray knows.
Yeah.
Which is nice. Interesting thing was, as I'm watching this, and then after I finished it off and I'm sort of processing it for that first time, I'm thinking to myself, boy, this would have been great to do as a 6 to 10 episode, like, limited series where you can take this, even just this story, and just stretch it out and add a little bit more and give us, because you've got, like, there's the world building of just the world itself and sort of the surveillance state that it's in, but that was really inconsistent. You had Fisk and his guys and sort of this whole idea of the augmented humans, where he's looking at them as almost a different race, right? Fisk mm-hmm. was. I want to know more about that. I want to know more about this Aaron Keene and his business and what Asha worked for and her business, like, all that kind of stuff you want to know more about. And then at the same time, you know, it's like all that's going on and you're like, oh, I need to know more about this, but then we're not going to tell that because it's really not the story we need right now for this little hour and 40 minutes.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, man, this would have been a great series. And then I find out there's a series in the works. So
right?
looks like we're getting
I was hoping
there,
that was the big reveal.
Yeah, which is, dude, I'm excited for that.
Definitely,
honestly,
yeah.
Now that I've seen the movie, that is exciting because I think that could be a fun way to dive into this world because you can spend some time with the characters like Fisk and his people, and you can spend some time on the political side of things, and you can play around with all that, and you can have more consistent police work too, because mm-hmm. the police, I mean, let's face it, cops in movies are kind of, it's either, they're either the protagonists or they're kind of useless. Yeah. Or they're corrupt.
Yeah, I had a big problem with the police character in this film. That's like, in terms of just like, not just like, oh, they could have done more, but in terms of like, I, you know, it seemed like a fundamentally unsound decision, because it's like, films often do this thing where when you have a protagonist and you have told, and you've created this as a character that like we as the audience have come to like, okay. I think it's fair to say that we all, you know, like the main character of this movie. We're rooting for him. We want to see him succeed. We want to see him, you know, find justice for his wife and all of that. And so when you have a police officer who's like really is trying to do good and probably even has a point, but is in direct opposition to the protagonist that we've been told and we've come to care for, then at that point, like we see the police officer as an antagonist as well. And it's like, so, you know, we don't really get anything from it aside from just, I guess, something of like a ticking clock mechanism or like, you know, okay, we're on to you, buddy. We see what's going on. But I never really bought into her pursuit. And again, it's like, you think these bad things about him, but you don't know. Like, we know because we see it. Again, like, we're in his shoes. And so the police officer becomes a sort of antagonist, but not like the main antagonist. And again, it was just like, and then, you know, also there's, you know, like, you also have to ask me to like root for like basically almost killing her in what should have been a much worse off condition she was in after that car crash. Because if she's going 70 on a freeway and this car's going backwards 70 on a freeway, she doesn't just get out of that like easily.
No, you know? Like, so, you don't walk away from that one.
You're not walking out of that.
No.
So again, it's just this odd thing where, again, it's like the officer has pure motivations. But as an audience member, I end up, you know, rooting against her because I'm rooting for the protagonist. And it was just a weird dynamic to introduce. I thought they just could have kept it out, or even better, maybe had that character be like some form of, you know, he's from a criminal underground or probably even better, some sort of international shadow conspiracy organization that is secretly funding the development of the STEM technology. You know, something like that, where it's like, okay, it's more of a pure bad guy, and then I can get into rooting against him, as opposed to someone who might have more pure motivations, and then it's like, I don't really know where I feel about this person.
Yeah, and there again is where just the movie itself is an hour and 40 minutes. We don't have time to dive into all that. A longer movie or a series does give you the chance to, because also I felt like Aaron Keen as a character, not really there much. It was funny. I watched a video. Somebody was like, the only reason Jared Leto isn't playing this character is because of the budget. And that made me laugh a lot because
I actually had him as a, so if our protagonist is a discount, Tom Hardy, I had him as a discount Rami Malek, even just his exact delivery, right? Like just the very like sort of like stoic kind of dead face and like talking very gravelly in this like near monotone kind of like down here and not emoting very much, right? And like just it seemed very much like, we want Raimi, but he's costs money because now he's been in a Bond movie, so this other guy.
Well, and at first I thought it was Dane DeHaan for a second.
Yeah,
when you first turned around, too, I'm like, oh no, that's not him. And it's an actor I'm not familiar with, Harrison Gilbert.
Yeah, it was,
he's fine. There's nothing wrong, like his performance is good, but the character itself just isn't in it enough, and they do try to pull the, you know, oh, he's the one behind it before the ultimate switch of, well, yes, but not really. But you know, it's like we were saying, a lot of these secondary characters are really more plot devices, and we're Gray is the character we attach to and we follow, and everyone else is just there to serve his story. So
and let's not forget, I want to say, you might have this information, but I think the budget was like $3 million front to back, all told.
Yeah, it sounds about right.
So, I mean, let's not forget, you know, to do a science fiction movie where you've got people with, you know, biomechanical implants that can, you know, shoot bullets out of a, you know, sort of like a David Cronenberg style, you know, metal device in their arm. And, you know, people have all these cybernetic, the idea is that people have these cybernetic implants. And then, you know, I think the idea is supposed to be that they're a little bit more common than maybe the film is able to express. And then that's why they ultimately need, I'm sorry, what's the guy, our protagonist's name?
I always forget. Aaron.
Aaron, yeah. So that, you know, again, like he's sort of one of the last, like, I don't know, pure blood or like, you know, untainted by cybernetics, right? Like, because
he's abstained.
Like, he's just been fundamentally against them his entire life. And so, you know, it's a, again, it's sort of like an untainted sample, like you mentioned earlier, that STEM can work with.
Yeah. And, but it's just, it was a cool thing to do. And I love the look of everything. This doesn't look like a $3 to $5 million movie.
Yeah.
It really doesn't. Like, it look, it's punching way above its weight class.
Yeah.
And that is, that's to the, you know, the boosting of Lee Whannell. Like, for, I don't think this was his first movie. I think he had directed one thing before this, maybe.
Yeah.
And he, of course, he had written a few, and working with James Wan, which I did notice one of the names on the board for the apartment building was Jay Wan. I caught that real quick as they were going along. I'm like, all right, nice little Easter egg.
Yeah.
But he knew what he was doing here. I mean, as a director and a fairly young director, but obviously he learned some things from being around James Wan all the time, because he just makes it look good. And sci-fi is always tougher to do it. You know what reminded me of, because did you see The Creator?
No, no, it's been on my radar, okay, but I haven't seen it yet.
So The Creator, it's Gareth Edwards.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, he did Rogue One and Godzilla, and he does that too, where he can take a movie and make it look like more than its budget. Mm-hmm. The Creator looks like a $200 million movie. It was made for like 75.
Oh, wow.
It's the look of it is great. The story is fine. There's nothing wrong. It actually reminds me a bit of this, where like the story is very simple, very tropey.
Yeah.
But just the visuals of it are something else.
Well, yeah, because that's got our boy Greg Fraser behind the camera, who shot the Dune movies above, you know, in addition to a number of things. And he's just like doing insane work right now. Like the visuals that he's getting. If you haven't looked into how he shot like the Harkonnen scenes with like the infrared cameras on the black and white and all of that.
God, that was so good.
There's some features on YouTube that you can check out that are really incredible. So yeah, just anything where you're telling me like Frazier's on the camera, like I'm automatically in. And to your point, it's going to look twice as good as whatever they put into it.
Yeah. And you couple him on the camera with the visual effects they did. And then I find out later on that they do all this visual effects stuff in The Creator without mocap suits, without dots on anybody.
Oh, wow.
They just filmed everyone and then were like, all right, we're going to, and they didn't even decide who were going to be the androids until they were in post-production on some of the scenes. And then they would like pick them out of the background and do all the roto work and all that stuff there. Blew my mind. I'm like, that doesn't, that sounds like it's just a horrible way to do it, but apparently it, just, it was a lot faster.
It's one of those things you can't argue with the results, but like, we recently found out we did an episode that's going to post shortly on Fury Road, right? That we've all seen 1,000 times. Mm-hmm. And I did not realize until doing a bit of a deep dive that that movie did not have a screenplay. No screenplay ever existed. And they just had like a literal miles worth of storyboards that would like wrap around their office. Mm-hmm. And then because they had no screenplay, they didn't have any way to like keep track of everything. So they shot that film literally sequentially front to back. They're in a desert. And the producer's like, should we get the, you know, the later scenes that are here? And Miller's like, no, let's take all 150 people and move them over there. And then we'll come back here in a month. It's just like, what? Insanity. There's certain things where it's like, again, I can't argue with the results, but that sounds like an absolutely insane way to do something, right?
Yeah, it's not the way that I would do it at all. But that's why I'm sitting here talking about movies instead of making them, I guess. But yeah, like Upgrade just looks, I mean, for lack of a better word, upgraded. It just looks really good. And it helped, you know, you had a good cinematographer, darkening down everything helps too. It gives it that very noir feel, but also helps you with your visuals. And then I think from there your VFX can kind of because they didn't overstretch on their VFX either.
Yeah.
There's a lot of very simple stuff. Like And that's that 15 minutes into the future we were talking about, where it's not Minority Report. Everything doesn't have to look futuristic. You can go into a trailer, but then, oh, the guy's got a coffee table that the glass insert is a smart screen, like little things like that. And that's an easy thing to do. So it worked. It worked really well. And then on top of that, reading about the way they shot the action sequences in this was fascinating. I don't know how familiar you are with that, but they would hide a phone on Logan Marshall Green somewhere and then synchronize the camera to the gyroscope in the phone. So when he's moving around in the frame, it keeps him relatively centered, and it gives you that really interesting and intriguing look that all these fight sequences had. That was amazing. Like, and there again, that's something that makes your movie look better and sets it to a new level, is those fights happen, the action sequences, and immediately you're sucked into it.
Yeah.
Even something like the car crash at the beginning, you know, I know it's not the first movie to do the car crash where you stay inside the car the whole time. Several movies had done that. The first one I can really remember was probably Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol.
Okay.
Which was Brad Bird directed, the fourth one. And it was a car crash that happened where you never left the car. You were inside it the whole time. Mm-hmm. I love that stuff. That is such a cool way to do that. And it's, what's great about it is it's a great way to have a car crash on a lower budget.
Sure.
But yeah, this one looked great.
Yeah. They've come a long way. I want to say, I think, I could be mistaken about this, but when I think about it, I want to say it's like either Adaptation, I want to say, I think had like a really good, like in the car, where it's this quick one where it's the Chris Cooper character who was talking about how he like lost his wife. And yeah, it's just, you know, one of those things where, again, when you're staying there and it's done in like one take, I don't know, you know, what engineer, you know, came up. I feel like somebody on, there's like, you know, behind the scenes, there's a movie where some guy came up with some cage reinforcement way to do these inside the car shots, because it was somewhere in the late 90s, early 2000s, where all of a sudden we started seeing that a lot more. And these car crashes become much more visceral and much more real when you're sitting there like rolling with it. And it's not just the, you know, quick cut of like car coming around the corner and the close up on the face and then the this and that, you know, like it's actually done where you're in there and you're experiencing that car crash alongside your characters. So yeah, this has a really solid one of those as well.
Yeah. And then again, mixing in just the subtle VFX to it too. Like when he hits the roof, it's all screens. And so the glass doesn't just break. It kind of looks like an LCD TV you've hit and it's broken. And there's just a little bit more immersion to that. Because they're in that smart car. And then absolutely. Also, so the fight sequences looked great. From like a technical aspect, the choreography was really cool too, because the way Gray moved once Stem took over is very like stiff and robotic, which makes sense, right? It's an AI controlling him moving in the most efficient manner possible, which I thought was cool. But even like small touches, like in that first fight sequence, there's a moment where he's, you know, dodging punches and it's always the shoulders moving. But one of them, he dodges a punch to the face by the hand coming up and moving Gray's face. Because, and I thought about that and it's like, oh no, Stem can only control him from the neck down. He can't actually turn his head. So he had to physically move it. I'm like, that's cool. Yeah. That's such a cool way to show that. And just the way he would move and how quickly those fights would be over too.
Yeah. Like, dude, the ending of each of those fight scenes, especially like the first one with the guy in his cabin or whatever, like I'm not really a guy who's like a, you know, yell at the TV or exclaim out loud guy, but like when he like slices that knife through the guy's mouth, I literally was like, oh shit. Like just, you know, like
I did the exact same thing.
And I've seen this, like I knew it was coming, but still like, and I think part of it too, is because it's not really a graphic film. But it has these like two or three brutal finishes to the fights that it doesn't hang on it. It shows you just a half second enough to like, to see that the guy's, you know, the knife has been pushed all the way back to the dude's face and it like comes open like Beetlejuice or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like one of those things where it doesn't come away from it so quickly that it doesn't register, but it doesn't hang on it long enough to where you can like look on it to see where the faults are or anything. And so just, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, it's almost like they say like comedy timing is everything. Sometimes, you know, yeah. just a really effective shot, just knowing intrinsically and having that perfect instinct for exactly how much the audience needs to see, not a split, you know, millisecond more or less. This film is really good at knowing where that line is and playing to that.
And I definitely feel like that was Lee Whannell taking some notes from James Wan, having worked with him on stuff before and being able to,
for sure.
Cause there's definitely the horror, you know, body horror kind of, you mentioned Cronenberg earlier, sort of that aspect to certain things in here. Cause the surgery scene has a lot of that too, right? That surgery is typically, especially in a sci-fi movie, your surgeries are very clean. You might see like the incision and then that's it. This is like kind of almost brutal in the surgery moment.
Yeah.
And up until that point, the movie hadn't been overly bloody. We had the one gunshot from after the car wreck, but then we get the surgery, and then 40 minutes in is when that first fight happens in the trailer, and it ends like it goes through so many fun stages, right? Because the fight starts and it's, you know, jujitsu throws and all this kind of stuff, and then Stem takes over and it gets comical with the way he's moving and he's smashing glass on him. And like, there again was Logan Marshall Green being great. Cause this is going on. And I love his reactions to it. Cause his reactions are like, what is happening? Why am I doing this as he's, you know, just breaking glass over this guy's head and like, dude, please don't get up, stay down, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then it just flips and it goes brutal for a second.
Yeah, I thought that was actually the best part of his performance was like in that actual scene, because it's a really difficult thing to, you know, we've seen it a couple times, you know, Evil Dead 2, Jim Carrey does this, you know, where there's just certain actors that are, you know, physically gifted and they can make it seem as though, you know, their body is literally fighting against themselves in a way they don't want, you know? And so, yeah, for him to have the body control to be able to do these very advanced, you know, martial arts moves, essentially, to your point, but then also still emote from the neck up and have, you know, his head and his face literally conveying a different emotion than the rest of his body. You know, that's not something that's easily done. I mean, even just nailing the martial arts techniques in a way that, you know, looks convincing, I'm sure took a ton of training. So, it is funny to see this guy who's, again, you know, sort of fighting against himself, right? And it's funny that you brought up Minority Report, because there's a device of these sort of futuristic or cyberpunk, but whenever you can introduce a device where you have our protagonist who's being guided from some other character, right, that has some sort of level of omniscience or prescience or can see things that the protagonist can't, and they're sort of issuing direction. So that scene very much reminds me of the scene in Minority Report that you brought up, where he's in the mall, right, and he's with the I forget what they're called, but they're the three beings that are able to like see the future, and he's like saving the one that he's
the precogs,
and she's like, you know, okay, you know, make a left here, you know, wait, 3, 2, 1, boom, and then he moves, and then, you know, Spielberg cuts back and we see that there's like balloons crossing at the exact moment that the bad guys are going to see them. And so it becomes this very well orchestrated sort of cat and mouse game, right? Almost like a Rube Goldberg, where, you know, you're moving here and then that triggers this thing, which we see then triggers this. And it's always fun anytime you can do that effectively, and we as an audience get to have that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I love that kind of stuff. It was just great. And, you know, we get that fight. We get the fight on the rooftop after he goes to see the hacker. Mm-hmm. The fight in the bathroom at the old bones,
which has my funniest moment of the whole film, where, you know, he totally like ends up crushing the guys, and then he jumps over the one dude and he's looking down and he's like, oh yeah, you thought I was an invalid, but you didn't know that I'm a fucking ninja.
Yep.
I just so love good. The way he delivers that line. He's like crouched over him like a little ninja.
I did see somebody cut that together with Cypher from The Matrix. like the audio of that when he jumps on the guy
or something.
Yeah. And I was like, that's well put together. yeah, it's just like those for the pacing of this to be what it was and to have, you know, again, our first fight's not till 40 minutes into an hour and 40 minute movie, but it doesn't feel like it takes 40 minutes. Like it, that got done and I had to get up for something. I think the dog needed me or whatever. And so I paused real quick. And then I sat down. I'm like, wow, we're 40 minutes in before we get our first, you know, martial arts sequence. That's pretty good. Cause it just didn't feel like it. And it keeps moving from there. And so I really enjoyed just all of that. The like you get that ticking clock of, oh, he's got to get to this hacker before and get something shut off before like he gets completely shut down.
Yeah.
And you know, meanwhile, you've got all the people in the background doing their VR, which is kind of signposting us for what could happen to him later.
Sure.
And the whole idea of like the virtual world being less painful than the real world.
Yeah.
I loved all that kind of stuff. Like this definitely pulled from a lot of different sci-fi into what it was, and it worked. It all worked because it all hinges on Gray, on Logan Marshall Green. If we don't like him, if his performance isn't compelling, then we don't care what's going on. So he has to carry things, and he did. And then to have the physicality to do what he was doing. And like that final scene when he goes after Aaron, because we get him, you know, tracking down the three of the four people, or I guess he gets all four of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because takes out the one on the rooftop, which was another brutal ending that had me like, okay.
Yeah.
I should have been prepared for it. I wasn't prepared for it. And then he goes after the third guy or the last guy, which had a great moment in there where when they start things off, Fisk tells him to not be emotional. In fact, I captured that audio. Mm-hmm. Like, don't, you're getting emotional. Don't do that. But then Gray turns it back on him by the end of that fight and makes him get emotional. That's what slips him up. And he, you know, Gray ends up winning it.
Mm-hmm.
So to go through all of that and then realize, oh, Aaron's behind all this.
Yeah.
Gotta go take him out. Goes to go after Aaron and then no, not really. Like he was being puppeted by STEM. All of that stuff with Gray in that scene was fantastic for me. Cause he's really struggling with like, he's realizing what's going on. And there was always, he was kind of towing that line the entire movie of he didn't like the violence, but the violence was serving a purpose that he did want. He wanted the revenge. He wanted the vengeance for the death of his wife and, you know, becoming a quadriplegic and all that. But it wasn't like he became Charles Bronson in Death Wish and just was like, I'm going to kill everyone.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't what he wanted to do, but it was the means by which he could get what he wanted.
Yeah.
And I did like that because he is sort of reluctant to do all of this. Meanwhile, STEM is like, this is the most efficient way to do what I need to get done.
Yeah. And yeah, it's really interesting when you have a film like this where, you have a protagonist that's, you know, almost like a passive protagonist, right? In a certain respect, you know, he's towing both lines because, you know, he and his body, his physiology, so to speak, are driving the movie forward. But in the back of our mind, we always know that, like, again, STEM's in the driver's seat. And so, you know, because of that, you know, again, it's almost like our protagonist is, just to your point, being puppeted along the entire time, you know? And in thinking about it, you know, by the time we get to the end of the film, which, I, you know, obviously we're deep into enough, so going into full spoiler modes here, people, because we have to sort of analyze this, right? You know, by the time we find out, you know, at the end of the movie where, like, you know, STEM ends up sort of taking over, then by the end of the movie, it can be said that STEM is the ultimate antagonist all along, right? And so... Yep. It's really interesting because now that I think about it, you know, perhaps the whole thing with the police officer is adding just one more person to juggle, because this movie juggles antagonists, so to speak. Right. So, you know, at any given point, we've got, you know, Fisk, we've got the cop, You know, we've got STEM itself. We've got Keen, like all this sort of stuff, right? Like all like, and at various points, all of them are like the ultimate protagonist, right? The guy that's ultimately trying to kill our protagonist or put an end to him or whatsoever. And so, you know, I think that that's one of the more interesting aspects of the film is, again, where it's like, there's never one true antagonist, you know? And, I guess that's sort of, you know, if you think about the way that an investigation might go with the PI, right? Like, I guess that's sort of how that works, right? You know, you start with one lead and it's like, oh, okay, you know, the bad guy seems like it's this person. And then you go and that lead ends up going nowhere, but you get a piece of information and say, oh, our bad guy must be this guy. Let's go down, follow this thread, right? And then, you know, that one ends up maybe being half true, but then the real bad guy is now this guy. And so you go down there. And so I suppose, you know, looking at it through that lens, yeah, it really is. It is kind of funny to look back and see that so much cyberpunk really is ultimately film noir, right? You know, whether it's Blade Runner, whether it's this, you know, the actual texts of Philip K. Dick and a lot of those authors, you know, it really is. It's these very immediate stories, you know, where we're following this person. There's usually, it's usually a central sort of mystery set up within the setting of like a futuristic world, you know. But again, they're all, you know, so many of these cyberpunk tales are ultimately at the end of the day, noir mysteries that just happen to take place in, you know, a future with all of the technology that accompanies that.
Yeah. And I think it's because it's a setting that works for that, because when you start getting too big, when you start moving too far back from the street, then a lot of the world, you either need to spend more time explaining the world, or what you have at the street level can start to fall apart if you think about it for too long. And so I think keeping it at that level, because, like, you know, Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049 do a good job of kind of balancing that out, where there's bigger things at play. There's more going on than is just what's happening with Deckard.
Yeah.
Or, you know, whatever. But we don't get all of that. We just get little bits and pieces of it.
That was the biggest surprise when I saw that movie. It's funny. I've always been a huge sci-fi guy, but for whatever reason, I was very late to Blade Runner. I think it was one of those things where, you know, certain things at a certain point, like they're too hyped up, you know? And it's like, for 20 years, 30 years, you've been told you have to see this. And you're just like, there's no way this could possibly live up to that. But then, like, you actually watch it and you're like, oh, okay, that was as good as everyone says, right? I actually didn't have that reaction to Blade Runner. I was admittedly disappointed the first time I saw Blade Runner, because again, I was expecting sort of like adult Star Wars. And the interesting thing about it is what you're talking about, which is the world of Blade Runner is very big, but the story of Blade Runner is very small. And to your point, there's a lot of this world that is left unexplored, or it's hinted at, or we see glimpses of it. But, you know, it's sort of that thing where it's like, you know, as a creator, as an artist, you know, you want to leave people wanting more. You know, it's like if given a choice between people wanting more or outstaying your welcome, right, get the hell out of there quicker and leave people wanting you to come back, so they'll invite you to the next party.
Yep.
So, you know, so that's kind of one of the interesting things about to look at is, all of these approaches to cyberpunk in these worlds have this similarity where the world is big and the story is small.
Yeah. And I think that works well, because you want that. I mean, part of the reason that, like, Firefly, for instance, still has such the cult following that it does to this day is that it only lasted one season and it got canceled, and it didn't stick around long enough to become, you know, the thing that it didn't like. I mean, Star Trek did that well with the Next Generation was getting long in the tooth by season 7, and they just they realized we're done. Let's move on. Let's end this. And that was smart of them to do, because I think had they gone beyond that, you know, you start getting into the territory of, look at a show like NCIS or even The Simpsons that's been on the air for 1,000 years. Like, you get to a point where you just run out of whatever juice you had to get you there. Lost by the end of it had people being like, well, what is going on? Because mystery box storytelling, you can only do for so long before you have to start answering some questions. Like, you just can't keep creating more questions. Which is why I think writing this and making this without the intention of it being a franchise or more stories, just making this like it's a pulp story.
Yeah.
Is the smart way to do it, because you get enough interest in this world. Like, I want to know more about the world of Upgrade. I want to spend more time in here, but if they weren't making the series or we never got another one, I'm not going to be upset by that, because I got this good self-contained little story.
Yeah.
But it does make you interested in more of it. So there's more places to play. And I think what you do is you do the same thing. You tell small stories in there. Big world, small story. It's kind of my idea of like, keep your story relatively simple, but make your characters really compelling.
Yeah.
And you're going to get into it. I mean, that's what Dune is, not a like crazy deep story. The plot of Dune is pretty simple, but the characters are what carry that.
Yeah.
And then the world that they're in. So that's the kind of stuff that I love. And this just ticked all those boxes and just was wonderful in that way. I just enjoyed the hell out of it. And on top of the music was great.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it had that perfect blend of stuff in there, the visuals, the world, all of it this was a lot of fun to watch. And I'm kind of mad that it took me 5 years to see it. But I'm really glad that I did.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me ask you, when Stem first actually makes himself known and like speaks out loud, like, did you know that that was a part of the movie? Like, that he had this thing in his head that spoke to him coming into it?
So I knew from the trailer that there was the one shot of him from that first fight where he like punches the guy and then stands up, but okay. I had no idea that it was going to talk to him.
Yeah. Yeah, and I didn't so see that. I didn't see that either. So like when that moment happens, again, it was like a big surprise. It was like, it wasn't like, it's not dramatic enough to be like, oh shit, oh my God. But just like this huge smile came on my face as I realized like, oh shit, like this guy, he's going to talk to us. And now we've got this like, you know, independent AI that's in this dude's head that's going to be like talking to him and controlling him and has this omniscience and stuff like that. And so immediately it's just like, you know, oh, dude, there's so much that we can do with this, right? Like, and you get, you just get a little bit excited to see what the filmmaker is going to do with that.
Yeah. And yeah, exactly. The comparisons to Venom make a lot of sense, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you know the character of Venom at all, you know that it's symbiotic and it talks to Eddie and Eddie talks back to it and all of that. So I totally get those. But what I liked about this was it's not the same. Like, Venom and Eddie reluctantly get along, but Venom is violent because that's just all Venom knows. Mm-hmm. And it's not like he started off in the comics as a villain, became sort of the anti-hero, but it's more of just like, that's all Venom knew. That's the world that he came from. And Eddie was so pissed off that he just ran with it. This was kind of neat because it's not who Gray is. He's not an angry or violent person. He wasn't like a, you know, he wasn't a petty criminal or anything like that prior to getting Stem. And Stem isn't evil for evil's sake. He's just AI, hyper efficient. And so there's that aspect of things too. There's the, you know, technology being maybe not the best thing in the world. and there's a little satire there and a little commentary on like, we shouldn't be putting implants in ourselves.
Yeah.
And on top of that, Fisk and his people, which is why I was really, it's that same thing where it makes me want to know more and it makes me want to explore more, is Fisk and this whole idea of the upgraded humans and the ones with the implants and how some of them view themselves as better and more than a regular human. There's some of that political stuff too, like, because it does feel like implants and cybernetics are more common in this world. And yet no one had seen the gun implanted into somebody's arm before in this police precinct. Like, that was new to them. So
yeah, it would have been nice to have seen if they could sort of like, because I feel like the intent was, it's like, okay, you know, we've introduced these sort of cybernetics maybe to, you know, modest degrees, right? Or maybe we've used them for, you know, people that have, you know, really aggressive. And I think that's what they try to do with the wife, is the idea that like this technology exists as a mean of like helping people who have suffered some sort of physical handicap, right? You know, so mechanical arms for people that have lost their arm, right? You know, some sort of heart regulator, people with a heart condition, something like that. And I think that if they could have, you know, just giving us a couple subtle interactions of people, maybe just speaking to that, or, even just a sort of throwaway conversation, like, oh, how's the ticker? Like, oh yeah, I got that new blah, blah, blah implant, right? You know, some sort of then introducing that, like, okay, now we have this sort of, like, because this is how it would go, which is right. Which is like the criminal underworld, so to speak, has now taken this, and now they're doing nefarious things with technology, right? So now they're introduced. So it's always one of two things. It's like the military and or the criminal underworld. And usually the military develops it and then it gets into the hands of the criminal underworld, right? And then that's where you're able to sort of examine the dichotomy of the morals behind weapons development, all that sort of stuff, right? It's rich, but obviously we've talked about, this story in particular is not here to explore those things. It's here to just put them out of the way. But to your point, I think it might have just helped it feel a little more real, a little more lived, and like the film is asking us to do some work on its behalf, right? So it could have been, again, maybe giving us that would have made it feel a little more lived in. But yeah, I didn't have it, and again, it's like it's like the idea of, playing with gremlins or trolls or something like that. Like, I know this isn't real, and it just so happens that I dig the hell out of this stuff. So, like, yeah, I'll play along with you, dude. Sure. We've got cybernetic implants, and I can shoot bullets out of my forearm. Love it. What else you got for me? Go on.
Yeah. I mean, look, there are certain aesthetics and things in a movie or a story that you'll hook me with immediately.
Yeah.
Cyberpunk is one of them. I think post-apocalyptic stuff can be really fun.
Agreed.
And I love, fantasy worlds. I just think that they're when you have that ability to really just kind of play around in the sandbox and do something interesting and make it your own and build off of what's been done before, Blade Runner comes along and it sets a style for a lot of the cyberpunk in visuals. And everyone sort of built upon it existed before that, but that's like the first one I can really think of, because that's 82, I think. So there wasn't a lot of cyberpunk visually before that.
Yeah, I mean, even just as a concept in novel form, it really wasn't until the 60s. Pretty much Philip K. Dick and Walter John Williams are kind of the two guys that get credited with that. Let's also not forget, it took a long time to get to the point where films were making the type of money to command the budgets necessary to make these worlds, up until then, it would be the Flash Gordon approach to Blade Runner, which is fine, but it's just hard to say, like, hey guys, I'm going to do a sci-fi, but I want you to take it like really seriously, and then you've got, snake people in rubber suits, in spandex. And it's like, well, I'm sorry, guy, like, this is not what's going to get me to take you seriously. But in 20 years, once the Hollywood blockbuster has been born, and now all of a sudden, movies can make $100 million, so we can spend 50, and then obviously that number has grown and grown and grown since then. But it's easy to forget that, once upon a time, a $10 million production was huge. I think Beetlejuice was made for like $18 million or something like that, and like, that would cost $150 million easy today to make the same exact movie.
They probably will spend that on that sequel.
I think they spent two, if I heard correctly.
But it's sort of like what happened with comic books, right? Comic books were looked at as a kid's medium for a long time. And as they grew and matured, the stories got more mature, and you still had the kids stuff and the stuff that would skew younger, but you could start playing around more in that because it became more established. And I think something like science fiction just had to go through those growing pains, and it took getting to, like, because you'd have more adult science fiction, like something like Close Encounters of the Third Kind, but that's not the same type as something like Blade Runner, which comes along a couple years later. So you needed those to just break the mold. But we had to have the guys in rubber suits and cardboard spaceships and all that first to establish all of that, build our way up there. And we see it evolve and change over time. And we end up getting to, I've seen in the chat things like Altered Carbon mentioned, Hotel Artemis and all these kinds of things. So it's really cool. Even thinking about going back to the 90s and like Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah.
And seeing like that's a great one. And you look at Did you see the live action Ghost in the Shell movie?
No, I didn't.
It's fine. Like, it wasn't as awful as I was led to believe it was.
Yeah, people like really hated that movie when it came out. Like, people were like passionate about it, which is why I kind of went out of my way not to see it.
Like, first of all, it's an impossible task to try and live up to that.
Right?
Like, you're not.
You have to know. Okay? Like, you're not going to make people happy, right? Like,
right.
Like, hey guys, I'm remaking the original Star Wars. Like, no, bro, that's not going to. You can't do
even.
That. You can't do it. Sorry.
Even something like I just saw Ghostbusters: Frozen Empire.
Yeah,
and I enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun because it just wanted to be almost like a live action episode of the real Ghostbusters, the cartoon.
Oh, nice.
Like it kind of goes in that direction a little bit. It's not taking itself too seriously. It's having fun because it's freaking Ghostbusters.
Yeah, like, exactly. Right.
It should be fun.
I'm looking forward to
it. And like, I'm seeing people talk about how, oh, it's a terrible legacy sequel. And, oh, I'm like, did you watch the first movie? The first movie is not like this bastion of cinema. It was four dudes with, you know, proton accelerators on their backs. Like, it's a silly screwball comedy from the 80s.
Like, what if the Caddyshack guys chased ghosts, right?
Basically, yeah. Like, I mean, I love the original concept. I love the fact that it started off.
Yeah, it's a classic film. That's actually, too, it holds a special place in my heart because it's the first movie that I ever saw before I could even remember that I saw movies. It was when I was a little baby, my parents took me to a drive-in movie theater. And they said it was funny because obviously the first scene comes on and there's, you know, the librarian ghost that like turns and like roars to the audience, right? And so for a split second they were like really scared for me, but then I started like laughing and giggling and they were like, oh, okay, cool, this kid's gonna like it. So and to this day, like, horror comedies, like, there's only what, five of them that are really very good, right? But Evil Dead 2, Ghostbusters, Monster Squad, handful of other ones. Like, when they work, like, they're just perfect, pitch perfect.
Yeah. Yep. And, but like, to have stuff like that is fine. And the reason I bring up Ghost in the Shell was it's cyberpunk. This feels like more like Ghost in the Shell maybe than the live action one did. That one had a little too much polish to it at times.
Okay.
And I feel like cyberpunk needs to be a little grimy. It needs
absolutely
to be dirty.
100%. Yeah. It's always dealing with like the dregs of society. There's usually criminals, you know, private investigators, you know, there's usually like a lot of, you know, drug use and corruption and violence. And it's really just the sort of like, you know, criminal underworld and crime thrillers. It's like, you know, a Tarantino movie, but 100 years in the future or something. Right.
Yeah. And it's why, like, my favorite sequence probably in Minority Report is when he's getting the eye implants or the eye stuff done, because that movie did a good job of mixing like the clean aesthetic with the grimy, dirty parts, I felt like. Yeah. And that was the one. Plus, it had Peter Stormare. And if he's in a scene, if he's in a movie, I'm in. This had that. It had that grimy, gritty look. And then for him to be driving, you know, muscle cars, and you get that mixed in with those automated, you mentioned the Cybertruck. Had the Cybertruck been announced by then? I don't
think so. I think it's just pure coincidence, but like, I don't know. I mean, that vehicle looks ridiculous as it is. I mean,
it really does.
Drawing. are you much of a Simpsons fan at all, by chance?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, every time I see a Cybertruck, I think of it's like early season one or two where he meets his brother, who's the successful car manufacturer. He says, go ahead and design any vehicle you want. And he designs this ridiculous car with a bubble top and it ends up like going out of business. Like, that's just, every time I see Cybertruck, I just picture Homer with like his ridiculous drawing.
Yeah. But to mix all that in, like, what I also would love is a story told in this world that is the, like, we're in the Bronx. If we're going to use New York as a metaphor in this story, I want to see what's going on in Manhattan, you know, the nicer areas.
Again, one of those budgetary limitations, right? It's like, I would 100%. Love to show you the glitzy, glamorous future, right? The metropolis world, you know, the shining, shimmering, but it's, again, you know, I've got $3 million. I'm lucky that I can even just get this thing done, let alone have budget for that.
But, oh man, for $3 to $5 million, whatever it was they made this for, boy, they nailed it. And little things too. Like I'll go after I watched the movie the first time and just let it wash over me. Then I went back and I kind of did a second watch, sort of paying attention to a few scenes that I remembered and like listening for some audio to capture that kind of stuff. And hearing, putting on some headphones and really paying attention and listening when Stem would talk.
Yeah.
The audio for that was so good because it was that late 90s, early 2000s overcompressed audio sound. Mm-hmm. They overcompressed all that audio, so it sounded like something you would have on your PC.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It was perfect.
Also, they, you know, one of the things that I think is just a cool little subtle detail that they added is how there's actually no text credits at the beginning of the film. It's literally just a voiceover narration of, you know, a very, to your point, compressed female AI who's talking the credits out loud to us. And then they're just represented by the visual sound waves on the line. And then it's like this vortex opens up and we like go in as she says the title of the film and then it opens. And again, like it's not going to make or break the film, but it's kind of one of those details where when you're already, when you kind of are already in and you decide, you know, you realize that you like this thing, it's one mm-hmm. of the little details that just makes it that much richer and that you can just point to as, you know, yet another example of, you know, what this film does really well.
Yeah, no, it's great. Yeah. I did get a few audio clips I got to play because there are some, please, there are some yeah, good absolutely. Little moments in here. We've all, if you've ever worked on a car, or you've done anything to a car, we've all done this where you get ready, you start it up, it does start, which by the way, that Trans Am sounded amazing. And then he just, I just loved his reaction. This immediately made me like the character.
I love you.
It was so good. So then to turn around and as soon as his wife comes home and he tells her,
you do realize that you're talking to a car, right?
I hear you talking to yours all the time. At least mine can talk back.
She's got a point.
Yeah.
Like.
oh, yeah. No, I talk to inanimate objects all the time. I'm constantly yelling at my stove, you know, whatever it is, things like that.
It's just me and my dog. So I'm either talking to her or I'm talking to whatever inanimate object is in front of me.
Yeah.
maybe I've got a problem. I'm not sure. But. And again, the movie went out of its way to establish their relationship is real good right at the beginning. And I, you know, love when movies do that. But like, I just liked this line.
Bet you 10 bucks I can get them off.
When he's talking about her wearing the pants in the family.
Yeah.
She's doing all the work. Bet you 10 bucks.
You know, that is another interesting aspect that we didn't really touch on. Again, just to have a character who is this, you know, much of like a man's man, for lack of a better word, right? Works on cars, mm-hmm. all that. Like that guy is pretty much never the stay-at-home husband. But, you know, he is in this film. And that's kind of an interesting little wrinkle. And you also get the sense that like it doesn't – like he's kind of come around to it and he's like, yeah, you know, this isn't so bad. I can work on my car. Do all this sort of stuff. So it is – it's kind of a – it's an it, – like – from a screenwriting standpoint, like it's kind of an interesting decision because normally those two things, you know, would be a juxtaposition, yet somehow they work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. And this was just too funny not to get. It doesn't really make a lot of sense, but at the same time, it kind of did. When he's trying to get her to go with him to drop the car off, and she says, "I can't go with you."
Can't lives on Won't Street, lady. You're coming with me.
Not sure what you mean, but yet at the same time, I understand exactly what you're trying to say. I don't know. It's funny to me. And then we go and we meet Aaron, which is a great introduction. He's just like touching a cloud. And I just loved that was cool. reaction. And this was just a good exchange.
What is the thing that you're touching?
It's my cloud.
Like, sure. No, just got a cloud in your house. In the most ridiculous house I've ever seen.
It's not that it's a cloud, it's that it's my cloud. Right?
Yes.
Very, very subtle but important distinction.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And then when she realizes who he is, right? And like you know, that would be like somebody from a small software company suddenly in the house of Steve Jobs. And they're just like, wait, hold on. You're Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
But then I just liked.
But we're getting there.
No, you're not.
He doesn't mince words.
That was probably like the most effective line of his. Just because, again, like, you know, it's. It's very reflective of character. You know, he's obviously a powerful person. He's not interested in social niceties, right? Like, and that usually trends, right? Like the technological genius, you know, just who's so smart that they don't understand how to interact with the rest of humanity, right? And just don't understand the social niceties and small talk and things of that nature.
Which was nice when they brought that up when he shows up at the hospital and, you know, he's got the mask on. He's like, I don't ever leave my house. Like, I don't deal with people.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't know how to do anything. So
it's also funny that even like pre-COVID, like they have this character getting mad at this dude for wearing a mask inside.
Yeah.
Except instead of like COVID, it's bird flu, right? Well, you're going to get bird flu in here, kid. Take that mask off.
And Gray 100% would have been that kind of guy.
Yeah.
Like he definitely feels like that dude. Another aspect, and again, I keep harping on Logan Marshall Green, but he's got to carry this movie, and the stuff with him where he sits there and has the robot keep administering his medicine to him, like he's trying to OD and the robot won't do it. That the way that scene started out, because this was, he comes home and this is after his mom is like trimming his beard and all that, right? And he breaks down. Which was emotional, and I really felt that.
Yeah, that was a very effective
scene. And he breaks down there, and then we see him, and as that scene starts, and I realize what's going on, I'm like, oh, I mean, it totally makes sense why he would go there and start trying. He's trying to OD, and his robot is like, his AI in his house says, no, I can't do that. So then here's Aaron showing up at the hospital, like offering him, you know, the stem, and just the way he's,
I'm not looking to restart my life.
Like, he doesn't, he just doesn't want anything at that point.
I really like the immediate, because he says, I think his follow up is, he says, I'm looking for the off switch.
Yeah.
I also like the finish of that quote, too, just using that language.
Yeah. Because, again, he's a very, like, nuts and bolts mechanical guy. Mm-hmm. So it kind of makes sense that he would kind of talk that way.
Also possible foreshadowing to the end.
Could be.
Mary's possibly a robot, maybe.
Mm-hmm. This one just says please, and I'm trying to remember what that was. So
please don't get up. Please don't get up.
Oh. He's hit the guy with like a mug, a plate, something else. I just love that whole please stay down. Don't get up. And which is great, because usually you get that from like the overly macho fighter of like, stay down, don't get up and all this. And here he's begging the guy not to get up because he knows it's not going to go well. And he has no control.
I'm not telling you to stay down. I'm asking you to please stay down.
Let's see. This one says second. I think I know this one.
Okay, just give me a second, okay?
1 second has passed.
Look, I didn't mean a second. I just mean hold on, okay?
1 second has passed. Like, come on. Come on, STEM. You know what he meant. But I will never, ever get tired of, like, that's a Data joke, right? From Star Trek. Like, somebody would say, give me a second. He'd be like, okay, that's a second.
Which is honestly, it's also funny because they also use the same thing for Drax in Guardians of the Galaxy, where it's just like, hey, you like a computer, you only know how to take things literally. And then that's where the comedy comes from. Go.
Mm-hmm. Which this movie had a great dark sense of humor throughout. Like there was a good balance of the brutality and the dark humor. Cause it is by the end, very nihilistic in a lot of ways.
Yeah. You get the sense that like Lee Whannell really is sort of like a multi-genre guy, right? Like I know he's kind of making a name for himself in like horror and to a lesser extent with sci-fi with this one and a couple other projects. Mm-hmm. But you know, when you watch these films, like you get these various, you know, like you'll watch one of James Wan horror movies, but then there'll be good, you know, dramatic beats. And then, you know, we'll watch this sci-fi movie and Upgrade, and then there'll be like interesting horror beats, you know? And so just the way that he's able to, or, you know, interesting comic moments. So the way that he's always able to sort of be like, okay, you know, here's the main genre that we're in, but there's also going to be these sort of like layers of tonal subtext that give it either a, you know, a levity, or, you know, on the other hand, you know, a certain weight. But it's like, yeah, there is just, again, this almost like, even when things are brutal, there's this almost lighthearted undertone throughout the entire film. And it's not, it's really hard to put your finger on it, because it's not like it's a jokey film per se. It's not mm-hmm. that it takes itself, it doesn't take itself seriously. It does. But at the same time, yeah, it's able to keep this tone where, you know, it doesn't seem cheesy or like inconsistent when it does these things. It just feels part of this cohesive package that, again, you know, that's one of those things where it's like, I don't really know how you pull it off. Maybe just, you know, because you were, you know, you're being genuine, you know, he didn't try to force anything. He just sort of let this come out, and, you know, this yeah. like, oh yeah, I didn't really expect to go jokey with it, but it kind of went here. And so, you know, rather than fight it, I just embraced it. Then, you know, try to imbue that elsewhere to make sure it felt organic.
Yeah. Cause it's satire. There's satirical elements to it, but it never gets quippy. Like it's not your Marvel Tarantino style of dialogue and like quips and one-liners. The humor in it gets kind of baked into the actions of what's going on without it being slapstick. So
yeah.
Or even something like, you know, where he comes into the bar in his wheelchair and he orders the drink. And I like, you know, just the subtlety of like the bartender pours the drink and then jams a straw in there, knowing the guy's going to need a straw. And then he's got to turn to the other dude at the bar and just say,
"Would you do me a solid and hold that glass where I can drink it?"
It was so good. Let's see. This one says car.
What makes you think that I don't need my car anymore?
There was something in that delivery that just got me.
Yeah. Also, speaking to the sort of like unexpected levity that I was saying a minute ago, even just the way that they, I think it's also just the language like that it's shot under. Because even just the moment where he wheels himself out of the bathroom, right? You know, like,
yeah,
the shot where you hear the screams and it shows all the patrons and they obviously think that it's the guy in the wheelchair getting beat up. And so then, you know, the way that, you know, it just shows him like wheeling out of the bathroom, you know, and like everyone's kind of staring like, what? And he's like, yeah, you might want to go in there and take care of that. You know, like,
yep.
It's again, it's just almost like that, you know, that's like almost like a sitcom beat. But it doesn't feel cheap when it happens. It doesn't feel forced.
No, not at all.
It's pretty impressive that he can pull that off.
Yeah. So this was him. These last two are from that fight with Fisk. And I just liked it because this line from Fisk,
"You're getting all emotional. Never do that."
You know, was really good in the moment. Like it on its own, that's a great moment, because here's Fisk who's looking at him now as, no, you're one of us. You're an upgraded human now. You're no longer just a human, and we're better than them. And then the whole idea of, "You're getting emotional, don't do that." And Gray is smart. He's clever, and he realizes that's how you can use that against him. So when he does do that, catches him off guard by making the connection that the first guy he killed is his brother. But he did it because he needed to. That was self-preservation. That was the only way he was going to survive that, because Fisk had the gun to his head. And so then his reaction is,
"Thank you, Gray.
I'm not proud of that."
Like, that's where, you know, he's not he hasn't been corrupted by the AI. Like, he's still a good guy, because he's not proud of what he did, but he also is like, I didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
That's that anti-hero type of thing going on.
Yeah. Can we also acknowledge that like android antagonists are all typically like one of the best parts of that movie, right? Like, Fisk was one of my favorite parts of this movie. Like, I really love that character. And then it's the same way that, like, you know, Rutger Hauer and the other androids in Blade Runner, right, are like, you know, pretty much one of the best parts of that movie. You know, Arnold Schwarzenegger in Terminator 1, Robert Patrick in Terminator 2, right? There's just something about, like, like murderous androids that I don't know if it's just the actors really get into it and they have a lot of fun with it. I just know that I usually end up, those are like oftentimes my favorite character. And the other thing that I really like about the Fisk character specifically is that, you know, what's interesting is that he was, so all the time that he's trying to, you know, kill our main character, he's also somebody who was once him, right? And so It's that thing where he's trying to kill him, but only because he won't join his side, you know? Like, that's like objective number one. Like, as they're fighting, he's like, stop fighting who you are. You're one of us, right? Da, da, da. And so it's this thing of like, I really want you to join my team. And if I can't have that, then I'll have to kill you, you know? Yeah. But also, if you can just join my team, then we can be pals. And like, I don't really want it. And so it's, again, it's an interesting character dynamic to be like, I want you, but I'm going to kill you unless you're willing to have me, in which case we could be friends. Like, and again, it's just anytime you have interesting character dynamics like that, it makes, you know, for a richer experience.
Yeah. And Benedict Hardy as Fisk. I mean, not a whole lot of screen time and not a lot of depth to the character, but boy, he was good in this. Like, he was just compelling.
Yeah.
Every time he was around.
Absolutely.
I mean, look, Upgrade. I'm so glad you latched onto this one. This was a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And,
if you haven't watched it already and we've already gone through and spoiled it all for you, just go watch it.
It doesn't get it's still wrong, good. Like, it's still good. It doesn't rely on the spoilers. It's still, like I said, this is my at least fourth time watching the film, possibly as many as sixth. And again, still, even just getting a couple years space from my last viewing, those surprises still worked. So it's still just a ton.
Yeah. And it manages to do the sort of whodunit and then double switch on you well. And, you know, typically I like a happy ending. I'm not against a downer ending. This definitely has that in a lot of ways, but sort of does and sort of doesn't in a weird way.
Yeah.
Because ultimately Gray gets what he wants, which is to basically be back in his old life and have his wife around. Because you could have easily had that whole idea of his mind breaks and STEM puts him like in a room basically inside his mind and takes over his body. You could have done that in sort of the Twilight Zone way of like, now he's stuck in this room and he can see what's going on, but he can't do anything about it. But instead, STEM was at least good enough to him to be like, all right, you can have this. Just go, you go do that thing over there and I'm taking over.
Yeah.
So it's both sides of that coin. Gray kind of gets what he wants. STEM gets what he wants. Who knows what's going to happen now to the rest of the world, because they got to deal with a fully autonomous STEM. I dug the way the ending played out and all of that. So I just had a blast with this. I'm definitely putting this into a rotation. I'll watch this every so often.
Yeah. And honestly, dude, I do like a downer ending. I mean, I'm kind of here for that. And especially, and to your point, I really like the ambiguous endings or the, you know, it's both a happy and a sad ending, right?
Yes.
Because to your point, emotionally, you know, he reunites with his wife. And so, you know, there's that, you know, sense of reconciliation, and she's obviously a very effusive and charming presence. And so we're happy to see her on screen. But then also when you take a step back and you're literally just looking at like the, what actually happened, like that's super messed up, dude. Like this robot took this guy's psychology and they've been like battling back and forth, you know, as for control of each other. And then basically the artificial intelligence is able to take him and be like, okay, I'm going to lock you in a room here and I'm going to like dress it up real pretty. And I'm going to make it a sort of like zoo exhibit that you don't know that you're in, but also like you are a prisoner of mine. Like I have stashed you here in my attic and you know, I am taking over. And that's just like, and then again, you know, the implications of, you know, what happens the moment that he leaves from that house. And then the other thing that I like too, is that it does leave a slight window open. So for example, like let's say that the TV show decides to like continue exploring this character or something like that. You know, there is a future where, you know, some character is able to maybe infiltrate, you know, or hack STEM and, you know, literally like go into that room and be like, hey, you don't know this, but you're fucking trapped in here. I'm going to bust you out. Let's go. And then maybe like that sets up him battling STEM for control of his body and mind back, you know, in like a later episode or something. So like it sort of leaves a seed where you can do a lot of interesting things creatively down the road, or you can just leave it there. And like either is going to work, you know?
Yeah. Yep. No, I'm with you on that. 100%. The best way to end this movie was the way that they ended this movie. And the fact that, again, it can be that self-contained story.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to go any further in this particular story, but we can play around in this world. And that's what I would want. I sort of felt like that with, in a way, and it's funny because you mentioned Terminator. Terminator, the first Terminator movie could have ended, and we could have had more stuff in that world without dealing with Sarah Connor, per se. And I would have been okay with that because I think that first movie is so well contained. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times that happens with a real good movie. Alien is the same way. Like Alien didn't need to continue on, but we were able to find ways to tell new stories within that world that worked. So yeah, I'm all about that. But this was a ton of fun, Jason. It's been too long. I think it had been a little about a year and a half since you'd been on. So
yeah, yeah, definitely. Good to meet you back. A little bit longer. So yeah, we'll definitely have to make it a more regular thing, and we'll have to next time we'll have to do something that I haven't seen.
Yeah. Now you have a show, Esoterica Cinema.
Yes.
Let people know about that. Where can they find it?
Yeah. So we actually had our first three seasons. We came out in 2020 where we were just an audio podcast only. You know, as such, if you're looking for the audio podcast, we're available everywhere, Apple, Spotify, you name it, Amazon, we're there. And then recently we have actually introduced the video version of our podcast. So the 2.0 reboot. So I think we've had about 15 episodes that we've recorded now in video format. So you can find us on YouTube now as well. So for video, head on over to YouTube, Esoterica Cinema. And then for the audio podcast, again, wherever you listen to podcasts, Esoterica Cinema. EsotericaCinema.com as well if you want to learn a little bit more about us.
Excellent, excellent. Now, this show I do record typically Sunday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern time. But we're doing this one a special Dragon Con digital media takeover on a Wednesday night. So that's a lot of fun. You can find the show in an audio form anywhere you get your podcasts, video also at YouTube. So just like you, I'm doing kind of the same thing.
Nice.
And because this is the Dragon Con stream, I am going to mention I'm going to be at Dragon Con this year. And I'm going to be doing this show live at Dragon Con this year. So,
that's awesome, dude.
If you want to get to a live taping of it at the con, come check us out. And I'm sure I'll be back probably on this stream at some point as well. But my streams you can get over at Twitch, twitch.tv/TVsTravis, and also youtube.com/@TVsTravis. And there's TVsTravis.com. You can check out all the stuff that I'm working on. I've got new content to put up there soon and projects that I'm working on. And you can also find links to like merchandise, Patreon, patreon.com/WYHS to back this show for as little as $1 an episode. That helps me get to go to things like Dragon Con. So if you can do that, I appreciate it. If not, and all you do is listen or watch, I appreciate that too, because I do this because it's a lot of fun.
And real quick, I gotta say, I'm sure I got my own merch right here. TV's Travis.
Oh, look at that.
So good quality too. Not just, you're not just supportive, you get a good quality shirt as well. So
that is awesome. I think that might be the first shirt I've seen in the wild. So thank you for that.
Also, if you notice, it's purple and green, much like the lights behind you. So we're synchronized here. We didn't even know it.
Perfect. Well, Jason, thank you so much. This has been a blast. We're not going a year and a half without you coming back. We'll get you back on here. I'm going to find something you haven't seen.
Absolutely.
I'm going to get you to watch.
Yeah, no, thanks so much for having me, dude. Like, I really enjoy talking with you, man. Like, you're one of the first people that I met, you know, doing this whole thing with the podcast. Super glad that we're able to stay in touch, you know, kind of grow alongside one another. And yeah, man, again, love watching movies, love talking about them with you. So hit me up whenever and we'll make it happen. And then, you know, if you ever want to come up on our show, now that we finally got all of our, quirks worked out and we know our show, we're getting into guest spots too, man. So I'll definitely be hitting you up and inviting you on our show if you want to come on.
Oh, always. I love doing guest spots. So can't wait for that.
Awesome.
Now next episode is actually coming up, on Sunday. My buddy Josh is coming back. I'm going to watch, I'm going to fill a gap in my Coen Brothers because I've never watched Blood Simple. I'm a bad Coen Brothers fan. I haven't seen that. He started talking about it. So we're doing that. That's coming up, this Sunday, the 31st. at twitch.tv/TVStravis. You'll be able to watch me talk about the first time I ever saw Blood Simple. So that'll be a lot of fun. So until then, for Jason, I am Travis saying to enjoy your movies, everybody. And yeah, let's be excellent to each other, even in the world of Upgrade. It's been Wait You Haven't Seen.
I was an invalid, but you didn't know that I'm a fucking ninja.
While I am state of the art, Gray, I am not a ninja.
Love it.
I love that so much.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.